So we're down at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And for those of you that don't know about this festival, it is a collision. It is an amazing event. You have experts, entrepreneurs, movie makers, storytellers, everything you can imagine is here, and there are intersections going on. Whether it's in plays, movies, talks, panels, it's an incredible place to be. And one of the cool things is, we got the talk with Dan Held. And Dan is a director of growth at Kraken, but what he really is a Bitcoin expert. Now, Bitcoin is one of those things of where a lot of people have a lot of strong opinions. I've heard people say, there's no value in this. This is a fake currency. It's got a real problem. We've got to regulate it. Others say, I've made a lot of money, and this will actually help people across the globe that maybe didn't have access to currency, maybe couldn't get currency because the banks were in their way, that there's a lot of humanitarian benefit for this. So there's a lot of questions about it. The environmental concerns, does it put too much CO2 into the world? Is it used by criminals? Are there problems there? Is it too volatile? So be honest on this one. As I was preparing to talk with Dan, I was skeptical. I'm reading, I'm looking into this, and I'm thinking, I have concerns about this currency. But there wasn't one tough question that I asked that he wasn't able to thoughtfully look at it and help me think about it in new ways. And frankly, it's gonna take me a couple months to process what he was talking about, because I couldn't throw anything at him that he didn't have an incredibly thoughtful response.
Bitcoin offers an inflation-protected asset, one that is digital, digitally native. You can move it anywhere. You can transmit it across the world. You can store it where no one else can have access to it. And you can store your wealth in that, which protects you from policies like the government printing money or forcing you to hold their currency. We've also seen this play out in Ukraine and Russia, where in Russia, the ruble dropped like 80%. Yeah. And so, you know, the Russian citizens aren't necessarily at fault for what's happening in Ukraine. It's Putin, but they're being punished for it. And so if they had their assets held in Bitcoin, they would be sheltered from that sort of action.
GovCon different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
Dan, awesome to talk with you today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I'll get us started. I've got a neighbor who he took 5% of his portfolio. This is, you know, his retirement, and he invested it in Bitcoin. He's made a killing. He has doubled his portfolio. So every time I see him, he's like talking about it, and he's addicted almost.
He's your Bitcoin friend, the annoying one who talks about it all the time.
Yeah, but so I've got my Bitcoin friend, but then I have, let's say, the grizzled executives that I know, you know, and they're in their 60s and their 70s. They're like, I don't like this stuff, but there's no value in it. It's not tangible. So I'd love to get started with just your thoughts on, in the simplest terms, when we talk about Bitcoin, what are we really talking about? Because I hear a lot of people acting like they know what it is, but I'm not sure they do. So I'd love to get your thoughts on what we're talking about.
Well, first and foremost, if it feels confusing, it is confusing. Bitcoin is a piece of technology that has a lot of intricacies to it. Mm-hmm. John Oliver, the comedian, had a really funny phrase where he said, Bitcoin is everything you don't understand about money with everything you don't understand about computers. Or at least that's how it feels.
Right.
And he's not wrong. You have to understand a little bit of like economics and what is money. And you have to understand how the blockchain works and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's not uncommon for people to feel that way. But Bitcoin, in its most simplest terms, it's a store value asset. It's a gold 2.0. Mm-hmm. And so Bitcoin allows people to store value that can't be diluted. There's only 21 million Bitcoin. There'll never be more. Mm-hmm. And transmit it to whomever else they'd like across the world. So it's immutable.
Right.
So that means it's not censorable. And that's Bitcoin's value prop and why people use it in a nutshell.
Okay. So how does it work behind the scenes, right? Like, how do we get at the Bitcoins? And I've read a lot on this, but love to get your thoughts on the miners and what they're doing and how they're creating that value.
Yeah, so Bitcoin has something called the Bitcoin blockchain. The Bitcoin blockchain is a series of blocks. And those blocks are 10-minute intervals, approximately. And Bitcoin miners use energy to essentially stamp these record logs into this chain of blocks called the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it allows us to transact and store Bitcoin in a way to where we understand who owns what.
Right.
So the Bitcoin blockchain is that permanent ledger where it can't be reversed, where if I send you a Bitcoin and then it's encoded in the Bitcoin blockchain, it can't be reversed. So that how that works is I sign with something called a private key. It's a fancy way to say something using encryption, mm-hmm. I validate that I am the owner of these Bitcoin, and I say that, hey, everyone, I'm giving this to Bob or Susie or someone else in the Bitcoin blockchain. Mm-hmm. The Bitcoin miners use their energy, essentially, to validate the transaction and then to permanently etch it in that time, that moment in time. That way, no one can go back and be like, wait a second, I meant to send it to someone else.
Right.
The miners are like, you provably signed with your unique signature, and then we validated it and marked it in the blockchain, so it can't be reversed. Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, in our day of cyber attacks and so forth, it's a heck of a lot harder to attack that blockchain. Is that a fair way of thinking about that?
That's a great way of thinking about it. Yeah. So let's put it this way. The unique signature that you have when you own Bitcoin, that's called your private key. Mm-hmm. That unique signature would take every computer on the face of the earth 10,000 years to crack that password if you do it properly. Mm-hmm. That's how secure the Bitcoin blockchain is. And then the Bitcoin miners there's some complex game theory here. And for those listening who don't know what game theory is essentially what entices the miners to behave properly. There's tens and tens of billions of dollars of resources that are used to mine Bitcoin. So it's very, very intensive. And that you can think of as like a cost that it would take to attack the Bitcoin blockchain.
Okay. So I want to get into a lot of questions today because you, of course, have been down here talking about the misconceptions. But before we even get into that, why are you passionate about this market? What is it about it? Because I think some folks are like, they're hesitating. I don't really understand this so well. So why are you so bought in on this, Dan?
Yeah, well, I was studying finance in undergrad during the 2008 financial crisis. And for me, seeing everyone on TV, everyone in all the books I was reading, everyone be wrong about how the economy worked and that we had placed trust in banks and trust in governments. For me, I was looking for a sound money alternative. And gold at the time was the only alternative. And then Bitcoin came about. And I found Bitcoin in 2011, 2012, mm-hmm. almost 10 years ago. And for me, that was a really exciting moment where I found this new sound money, this money that couldn't be altered by a government, where we could replace that trust that we had with the banks and the government that had been so misplaced during the 2008 sure. financial crisis and during 2020 and COVID, right? There was bailouts for various companies, trillions and trillions of dollars printed, and replace that trust instead with code and math.
Okay.
And that's what Bitcoin represents. And that's why I'm so passionate about it.
So for the average gal or guy that's out there that working hard, taking care of their family, they don't have this expertise in Bitcoin. Why should they care? What's the real benefit to our society, to our way of life in Bitcoin? What are some of the advantages of it?
That's a great question. That's ultimately what matters. Why does it matter to an everyday person, right?
Right.
Well, I'm sure they all look at their bank account right now and their salary probably hasn't met expectations of inflation to where sure. I bet a lot of people are going up on promotion season and asking for a raise because they're noticing that all of their expenses are going up. And that's due to inflation. That's due to government policies.
Right.
So they're starting to feel it in their pocketbook. And I think that's the first place where they should begin to explore these feelings is, you know, why is everything becoming more expensive? Why are my wages not going up? Mm-hmm. And looking at, well, where can I protect my wealth? Where can I protect my savings account? And a lot of people might say that that's like a wealthier person question, but it's not. Everyone has some form of savings,
right.
Whether it be $50, $50,000, or $5 million. Mm-hmm. So I think that Bitcoin offers an inflation-protected asset, one that is digitally native. You can move it anywhere. You can transmit it across the world. You can store it where no one else can have access to it. And you can store your wealth in that, which protects you from policies like the government printing money or forcing you to hold their currency. We've also seen this play out in Ukraine and Russia, where in Russia, the ruble dropped like 80%.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Russian citizens aren't necessarily at fault for what's happening in Ukraine. It's Putin, but they're being punished for it. And so if they had their assets held in Bitcoin, they would be sheltered from that sort of action.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I've read stories that, let's say, if you're in Haiti and maybe you don't have a bank or access to a bank, that now we can just digitally get that currency. So there are advantages from that side of it as well?
Yeah, there's a good way to think about this. So, you know, in Africa, they didn't necessarily have cable landlines developed through like the 80s, 90s, mm-hmm. like we did. So when the internet came out, our internet was first, you know, dial-up, and right. then we had cable. And now we have fiber. And then we have fiber and a mixture of that and cell phone towers. Mm-hmm. But what they have in Africa is just cell phone towers.
Yeah.
They don't have that landline infrastructure, so they sort of leapfrogged ahead and went straight to like cell phone connectivity.
Uh-huh.
And so when we think about Bitcoin, it's kind of like that as well in these countries where they're unbanked or underbanked. where they may not have this financial infrastructure, and Bitcoin is a leapfrog forward, mm-hmm. where instead of like old landlines, we're simply piggybacking off of old tech, it's entirely new technology. And so it's kind of like a different, like an entirely new financial system.
Right. Folks like Elon Musk have said this is the future currency. I mean, this.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people respect what Elon has to say. Rightfully so. He did PayPal.
Yeah.
Tesla and SpaceX, both of those, all three of those took on very established, entrenched sort of folks like the military industrial complex with SpaceX mm-hmm. and the automobile manufacturing industry with Tesla. PayPal, I mean, he's going up against all the incumbents, you know, in the existing financial system. And so, yeah, it's exciting to see folks like him, institutional investors like Ray Dalio, mm-hmm. and a lot of people come and realize that Bitcoin is the store of value, gold 2.0 asset. And this hasn't been how it's It hasn't been this way for a long time. Until about 2 years ago, most of them hadn't said anything publicly about
right.
it. So only in the last 2 years have we seen the whole world kind of wake up to Bitcoin being a gold 2.0.
So it's interesting as you're talking about, because you're taking on major forces of power when you're coming up with a new digital currency. I'm watching the new show on Uber, and talk about how he's taking on the taxi cabs and city government and all of those establishments. So a lot of what you're talking about, of course, a new paradigm, new way of thinking. So I want to dig into a bit. You talk about misconceptions of Bitcoin. And of course, you're here at South by Southwest speaking on that. What are some of the big misconceptions that you're seeing out there?
Yeah, there's a couple go-to ones. And by the way, I spoke on the only Bitcoin panel at South by Southwest.
Uh-huh.
So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I really had a great time there. But we fielded some Q&A. And so these are some questions I'll kind of pull from there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Bitcoin, there's a lot of things that people bring up. One, that it has no intrinsic value.
Mm.
I think that's a big one. A lot of people go, well, like as you mentioned before, you've got one neighbor who likes it. The other one is like, I can't touch it. It doesn't feel real.
Right.
So there's a couple different ways that I like to approach that question. One is I can't touch my stocks.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still real though.
Okay.
You know, but it's just in a brokerage account. It's only digital. I can't get physical stock certificates anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't make it any less real.
Okay.
And then also when you think about fiat money, like government money,
mm-hmm.
I like to pull a quote from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. And they said, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, just like the US dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, but neither does the US dollar.
Right. So the contrarians, and I'm thinking of some of my friends that are retired CEOs or retired executives, and they say, but there's an exchange of value. So if I have stock, there's goods and services, there's basis behind it.
Right.
And their argument is with Bitcoin, scarcity alone doesn't equal value. So your thoughts on that, right?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question. I totally understand where they're coming from. I studied mm-hmm. finance in undergrad. You build out a cash flow model to go value something. You go, well, this company produces X amount of goods or services, and that throws off X amount of revenue, and
mm-hmm.
we can back into a revenue multiplier and how much the value of that company should be.
Right.
So I totally get where they're coming from, where they're like, wait a second, it's only worth something because we all believe it's worth something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same as the US dollar, though. And so when we go and we look at Bitcoin's value prop, or like why Bitcoin has value, Satoshi actually writes about this before Bitcoin is worth a penny,
mm-hmm.
where he goes, imagine a scenario where there's a metal that's boring and gray in color. And I'm almost saying verbatim here, but I'm paraphrasing a little bit. But it only has a few magical properties. One, it's fixed quantity. It's simply scarce. And two, it can be transmitted anywhere in the world in a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, if for any reason people were to speculate if that asset should have value, that alone might be impetus for its adoption.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that before Bitcoin is worth a penny. So he understands human psychology at like a very deep level. Satoshi did. And so I think with Bitcoin, it's challenged not only my misconceptions over the economy or government, it's also like what makes people tick.
Mm-hmm.
Why would someone buy something like this?
So that's interesting. And for those listening that are not experts in this, Satoshi, who was the founder of Bitcoin, can you tell us just a little bit about who that was?
I'll try my best. We still don't know who he or she is.
Okay.
So Satoshi is a pseudonymous name.
Uh-huh.
So we know the name behind it, Satoshi, but we don't know who it is.
Yeah,
they're definitely not Japanese, it seems like. I think that name was chosen intentionally to be misleading.
Right.
And so when we look at, there's a couple of different like popular candidates for who Satoshi is, but to this day, we do not have a definitive this person or this person is not Satoshi. They took every single precaution to stay pseudonymous because they felt that if they were known, it would weaken the protocol's decentralization, or it would weaken, it would open up an attack vector where people could possibly influence him or her, which would then influence the protocol.
Okay, interesting. So when we look at this notion of digital currency, volatility, as you and I know, is a big issue. One day Bitcoin can be 60,000 per coin. A few days later, it can be down to 30,000. There have been months where $1 trillion has been wiped off the books. So a lot of the critics say, wait a second, if I have $10, pretty much I know I can go buy a meal at McDonald's. I can buy a bottle of wine, or maybe for $20.
Sure.
With Bitcoin, I don't know on any given day, you know, am I going to be able to buy a house, or can I buy a candy bar? I don't know. So how do we handle two questions in that, Dan? One is, why is it so volatile?
Okay.
How do we handle that?
Yeah, so I'll kind of answer that in a simplistic form, and then I'll give a longer form answer. One is that Bitcoin went from worth $0 to becoming a world reserve currency, or a gold 2.0, with no one intervening. Mm-hmm. It did that all by itself. And that's a lot of value appreciation that occurs. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wasn't going to be a nice linear form. Wasn't going to be a nice up a dollar every single day since its existence.
Right.
It's going to be choppy. It's going to have a lot of ups and downs. People coming and speculating on something's value, whether that be shares of Facebook, which dropped 30% in one day,
right,
or Bitcoin, that changes. And that's why the price changes, is buyers and sellers start to differ on how they believe or what they believe Bitcoin is worth. Mm-hmm. And when Bitcoin's going from zero to becoming gold 2.0, that's a lot of chop. Mm-hmm. So that's a short answer.
Yeah.
The longer answer is that money serves three purposes: store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. Mm-hmm. Store of value would be like gold or Bitcoin, has great properties for that. Medium of exchange is we use that to go pay for our groceries. Mm-hmm. And unit of account. Unit of account is that the groceries are priced in dollars. Mm-hmm. And so with gold and Bitcoin, we don't see that in everyday assets, right? We see them priced in dollars. And there's a couple of reasons why. One, if something has a stable purchasing power, like the dollar, it usually means that it has a stably declining purchasing power.
Okay.
That's what we call inflation. Mm-hmm. That's why when you talk to your money manager, they're like, don't keep your money in cash. Go invest it, because it loses value over time.
Yep.
So it's not a great store of value, but it's a good medium of exchange and unit of account. And so when we look at those types of monies that are good medium of exchange and unit of accounts, they typically have a centralizing controlling mechanism mm-hmm. to control the price. Mm-hmm. That's antithetical to what a good store of value asset is, because if someone can control it, then it doesn't have good store of value properties. Mm-hmm. Like if someone could completely control gold, then gold would lose its property as a store of value asset. Instead, gold mining is done all over the world, and no one can control the supply of gold or demand for gold. You can just simply buy it, and everyone else can buy it at the same time too, or sell it or buy it and mm-hmm. transfer it. So Bitcoin has very strong store of value properties, but right now it's going through the price discovery phase. We're going from zero to gold 2.0.
Yeah.
So it's going to be choppy for a while. Now, I don't think this will always be the case.
Okay.
I think Bitcoin a decade or two from now will become boring. If it does indeed become gold 2.0, it's a very boring asset. It's a risk-off asset.
Yeah.
To where the returns won't match what they did historically. It'll be flat. It'll be boring.
Right.
And then it might transition to becoming the medium of exchange and unit of account era. So the price is stabilized. Many, many, many people own Bitcoin. So there's a network effect of people might want to buy and sell in it.
So if somebody is in their early 30s and it's a couple and they're raising young kids, would you advise them stay away from Bitcoin? Versus, you know, somebody that's 50 years old, has a variety of money investing, that it's not necessarily for somebody that can't handle that volatility? Is that what you'd advise?
That's a really good question. I think that's very subjective to each person.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, if an investment makes you not sleep at night or you don't want to eat because the volatility is just tearing you up, then I don't recommend it. Mm-hmm. But you would be remiss not to think about it from a portfolio construction perspective. Mm-hmm. People build portfolios and they oftentimes don't know what's in them.
Right.
Like you own the S&P 500, I assume, like an index fund. So do I. I don't know those 500 companies.
I don't either. Yeah, absolutely.
But we know that diversification is a good strategy. Mm-hmm. So I think with Bitcoin, diversification is the strategy. And when you back test and look at adding Bitcoin to a portfolio, it improves your Sharpe ratio, which is your return per unit of risk.
Okay.
So even if you don't believe in Bitcoin, why not put in 1%? If you lose 1% of your net worth, you know what? I think most people can stomach that sort of volatility.
Goes back to my neighbor. Played with 5%, made a killing, got out.
Right. It could 10x then, and then becomes 50% of his portfolio.
Yeah.
And then that's very meaningful. And 5% or 1% is a very low risk bet in my book. But again, it's to each their own on how they want to manage their own risk.
What will sort of smooth out the chop, right? Over the next 5, 10, 15 years, how does it become more stable? What's that picture look like?
One word, adoption.
Adoption.
The more and more people who buy into it, the more and more people who believe in it, the higher the price goes, the more and more counterparties there are to buy and sell it. Mm-hmm. For example, 2 years ago, that's when the institutions started to come in. And so there's billions of dollars on each side of the order book of people wanting to buy and sell Bitcoin on any given day. Mm-hmm. If there's more liquidity there, that means that there's less of a chance that the price is going to really drastically swing one way or the other.
Yeah. Now, from this notion of stability, and this conversation fascinates me because perception, right? I mean, the dollar, right? It's a promissory note. It's a promise of value. So the perception of it is, well, it's backed by the full faith of the United States. And so therefore I can trust this. So when we're talking about perceptions, there are some, as you know, that say, well, wait a second, we should be doing stable coins, or is it Diem Facebook is offering?
Sure, yeah. Their former offering.
Yeah, former offering. Why Bitcoin versus that, which is backed by the US government, but digital?
Right. Yeah, so stable coins or CBDCs, so CBDCs are central bank digital currencies. Mm-hmm. They would be kind of like another evolution of stable coins. Mm-hmm. So existing stable coins, what they do right now is you would transfer dollars, like a wire, to a bank, and then that bank issues you digital versions of that dollar.
Right.
So we already have this to some extent, right? We do send ACHs, wires. Mm-hmm. You send money to your friends on Venmo or Cash App. Mm-hmm. Those are all digital payments. And so what this version is they put it on a blockchain. And you can transfer it back and forth. Mm-hmm. Now, with a stable coin like that, though, the bank, you ultimately have to trust that there's a one-to-one pairing, that mm-hmm. for every digital dollar on that blockchain, mm-hmm. that there's a dollar in that bank account.
Yeah.
We still have to trust someone again. Uh-huh. And so that kind of goes back to the whole point of Bitcoin is we don't have to trust anyone with Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. We don't have to trust that they have my Bitcoin there. I can own my Bitcoin outright. Whereas when you own a stable coin, you don't actually own it. You own a representation of that dollar in a bank account somewhere that you hope is there.
Yeah.
And so if the US government went to that bank and said, we want to freeze all these dollars, mm-hmm. then the ones on chain, on the blockchain don't really matter because they're all frozen.
Okay. So there's this notion of if we're in Bitcoin, that you can be anonymous, that you don't have people knowing what you're doing, transacting, where your money is. Yet critics have said that in the Colonial Pipeline hack, the government was actually able to track down some of whoever the bad guys and gals were and recoup some of that Bitcoin. So does that damage the theory of complete anonymity?
Yeah, great question. So I would say that's one of the bigger misconceptions, that Bitcoin is anonymous.
Okay.
Bitcoin is pseudonymous. So imagine there's a public record that we can all see, and that's the Bitcoin blockchain, mm-hmm. and your account number 55255, mm-hmm. and I'm account number 1234. Well, they may not know who you and I are behind those addresses, but that everyone can see the movements of money in and out.
Ah, I see.
So at any given moment, if you tie that to your real world identity, mm-hmm. then you could be de-anonymized. So that's what happened in the Colonial hack, is that these individuals did not preserve their privacy to such a degree that they couldn't be found. And so transacting very privately is very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin, in fact, is not a good tool for money laundering and drug dealing. US dollars are more commonly used for that. So,
really? Okay, that's a huge misconception then, because I hear the time, this makes it great for narco traffickers and human trafficking and all that. But actually not, because it's not as anonymous as...
It's all transparent. So if you take the risk of doing that, you would potentially leak your information and get caught. In fact, less than 0.1% of all Bitcoin transactions are illicit. And that analysis was done by Chainalysis, a company that monitors the Bitcoin blockchain for criminal activity.
All right, that was going to be my next question. How do we know that? You already answered that. I want to get into the blockchain a little bit.
Sure.
Because as you know, like all things that are new, there are passionate voices out there. There are people that hate this stuff, right?
Totally.
And I've read things that say that they call it basically that you have to be a fool to be involved in this. You have to believe that scarcity equates to value. And so people started saying, hey, I can just paint a few rocks And, you know, it's sure. a very limited amount and there's value. Or others have said things like, well, I could have students do math problems.
Right.
And then the first one to solve it, we create some sort of block or something. Okay, great, but where's the value? So I want to dig a little bit deeper, Dan, if we can, on that, because that
sure.
is the part where it's still hard to wrap my mind around, why is that valuable? That
yeah.
we're mining and the block is you, that creates the coin. But I want to go a little deeper on that, please.
Of course. Yeah. So all value is subjective, mm-hmm. Which is a bit of a, you know, we're going to get a little bit weird here when we get into this, because this goes down, this like challenges some of our core root assumptions of like utility value of money. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that money should have a core utility, right? So there's a lot of people who believe in the commodity value of money, mm-hmm. like, for example, like oil money or like wheat money,
yes.
that money should have some sort of commodity backing, because the concept of a money that's totally divorced from a base utility seems foreign. It seems mm-hmm. weird.
Right.
Money is a very strange thing, because money is this core unit between all of us that we use to transact. Mm-hmm. And what's great about that is it solves the problem of the coincidence of wants. If you want a sheep and I have a cow, in that moment, us both finding a counterparty who wants a sheep or a cow is somewhat improbable.
Yes.
But to find a counterparty for a common money or a common base money is much higher. Mm-hmm. So we transact into that, hold our wealth in that, and then eventually transact for the other type of item that we'd like. Mm-hmm. That's why we can go to 7-Eleven and grab a Coke, or go to the mall and grab a t-shirt
yeah.
using dollars.
Right.
Because we have that common sort of shared monetary instrument. Mm-hmm. When we look at what the origins of money and where it came from, money came from a very, very basic primitive of like shells and beads. And as those seem somewhat primitive, they do have similar attributes to gold and to fiat money and Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Money has different parameters that make it money. For example, it needs to be durable. Mm-hmm. Like if it was something very delicate, it would easily be destroyed
sure.
as we pass it through. It needs to be scarce. It needs to be divisible. Mm-hmm. For example, taking a dollar, we have coins that are the divisibility of a dollar. And so when we look at money, money is worth something because of these properties it has as a money,
yeah.
not because it has some core use to, I can burn dollars to create a fire, or I can, you know, if you have like an oil or wheat money, it actually dilutes the value of a money
uh-huh.
because then you're taking an asset or a commodity that has a core use, and then you're weaving in the money aspect. Mm-hmm. Money should just be money.
Yeah.
And its moneyness is what gives it value, and that moneyness are these parameters it has as money. And so Satoshi hypothesized, given scarcity and a couple other, you know, advances that he made in the moneyness of Bitcoin, for example, the divisibility. Divisibility can be divided into 100 million pieces. So Bitcoin is very easily broken down smaller, whereas like, for example, gold has a divisibility problem. Mm-hmm. You can't like shave off a gold flake to go buy a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
Like you could, but
yeah,
it'd be really
yeah.
difficult. Whereas like fiat money has very good divisibility. So there's all these different parameters. And so Bitcoin has more advantageous parameters as a money. And so its moneyness, or its ability to be a good money, is unparalleled, and that alone gives it value, which is a weird thing. And I know it's tough for us all to like kind of get down in the weeds of that, but that's why it's valuable.
It's fascinating, though, when you're talking about the perception of, we make assumptions all the time based on, you know, dollars, fluid currency. But I think about the movie Wall Street, which I'm a big fan of.
It's a great movie.
There's several famous scenes. You know, one of them is where Michael Douglas is showing Charlie Sheen, basically, see that painting on the wall? I bought it for $40,000. I can sell it now for $600,000. The illusion has become reality.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so when we look at other crypto things like NFTs, these are a great example of shared illusion of value, mm-hmm. which is art, digital mm-hmm. art or physical art. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's all the shared illusion of value and scarcity. Beanie Babies, I remember from the 90s, you know,
yeah,
Beanie
yeah, yeah.
Babies and... Those were also a shared illusion of value. And almost everything you realize in life is somewhat of a shared illusion of value. And
yes.
perception is reality. We simply believing in things give it value. For example, our government. Mm-hmm. If we all decide collectively tomorrow that we don't trust the US dollar, or we don't believe that various individuals in the government have power, then they lose power. So just simply believing in it gives them that, including religion and other things as well. But I don't want to go too far down those
rabbit holes. But I totally get it. Perception, buy-in, conviction. There's a lot of things that happen, and our minds are complicated. So I want to talk about, first of all, I got to be really candid. In doing the research, I'm reading on this and saying, it's unstable. It's not yet you're making great counter arguments that the best I can offer, Dan, is I got to go back and think on this.
You know, this is the right perspective to have, though. It took me months to get to where I am.
Uh-huh.
Actually more like years. But nowadays there's a lot of great content with folks from a wide variety of people in the space. And then some people will consider my content good about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's more of months now, but it takes some time. It's not something that usually you wake up and just all of a sudden go, you know what? This all makes sense. Let's put it this way. I've never seen someone immediately get it. So
I hear that. Now let's talk about some of the challenges. There are environmental challenges. There are perceptions that this will enhance the digital divide, that those that aren't sophisticated on computers and all of that will fall behind. But let's start on the environmental one.
Sure.
I've read that that Bitcoin puts more CO2 into the atmosphere than Norway and Argentina combined, or than Amazon, Facebook, Google, Alphabet, Apple. So is that the case? And if so, what do we do about that? Right? Because I'm fascinated by the notions that you're talking about.
Sure.
Obviously, you and I started talking about how beautiful California is.
Yeah.
So we got to take care of this planet. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I love the environment. I mean, I grew up, our family has a cabin in Colorado. So I go skiing in the winter, hiking in the summer. So
yeah.
I love the outdoors. And I love nature and I love the environment. That's something I want to preserve.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at when something uses energy, is that a good or bad thing? That's a very subjective question. So, for example, Christmas lights use more energy than some small countries.
Hmm.
I would argue Christmas lights are a somewhat frivolous activity. Or watching the Kardashians.
Yeah.
Or playing Xbox. Right. I personally play Xbox. I find it fun. But most people, including my girlfriend, find it's kind of silly.
Yeah.
It's something that they find frivolous because it's a game and they're like, this has no purpose. Well, when people buy electricity, they're free to do whatever they like with it.
Mm-hmm.
If we start to go down the rabbit hole of having people justify morally their consumption of energy for every single thing, then we start to reach a really scary place where like no one's morally correct.
Hmm.
Let's say you wash your clothes twice.
Okay.
Well, are you immoral for doing something like that? No one would ever question that. No one would ever ask you what you watch on TV, like Nova channel, like Nature channel versus the Kardashians and say
right.
like, oh, you're wasting electricity because you're watching the Kardashians. So Bitcoin fundamentally, energy consumption is a subjective thing and we shouldn't criticize how someone uses it. They paid for it.
Sure.
So who cares? Second of all, if we look at Bitcoin's energy consumption relative to the existing financial system, it uses magnitudes less. So think about what it takes, including this building right here,
mm-hmm.
to maintain the belief and trust in the US dollar.
Okay.
These massive buildings, extremely expensive to construct. All the people inside, all the energy that they required to live and survive. All of the energy required for all the bank servers and the US Treasury. And maybe you throw in the military if you want to use this as an argument, because the military enforces the strength of the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
And we're talking thousands of nuclear reactors on ships and submarines, and that's the energy requirement for the U.S. dollar.
You have thought about this deeply.
I've talked about this a few times before.
Yeah, so. That is obvious. Now, can we get better at this, though? I mean, I understand the subjectivity, the comparisons, and that's
sure.
well-reasoned. However, can we get better at it? The same thing with the Capitol building. I want them to get more efficient.
Sure.
Can we get more efficient, less polluting with this as well?
Yeah. So what's really interesting about how Bitcoin's energy consumption works. So Bitcoin miners take energy and they use that to validate Bitcoin blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that does is that protects the Bitcoin network, makes sure that everything is done orderly. What's really interesting with how Bitcoin sources that energy, though, is that Bitcoin miners don't care where they are. We could literally have Bitcoin miners on the moon. They don't need to be by city centers.
Okay.
So they don't compete with the energy that you and I use.
Mm-hmm.
Bitcoin miners are put at places where energy is being wasted. So the energy would have been wasted already. For example, like flared methane out in West Texas.
Right.
They would normally just flare the methane or burn it off. And I'm not sure if you've ever seen this, but driving out in West Texas, you'll actually see these giant flames that burn 24/7.
Uh-huh.
And that's them flaring the methane.
Okay.
Well now, so the problem was they couldn't like bottle it up and pipe it somewhere, because they would either lose it or it would be too expensive to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're tapping into it and mining Bitcoin with that instead. So Bitcoin miners are more of they're kind of like recyclers of like energy that was formerly being wasted or couldn't be transmitted to a city center fast enough. But most energy out there is wasted.
Yeah.
Most energy that's produced at a nuclear power plant or wind or solar is wasted. The reason why is because of physics.
Waste heat. My car engine loses 90%.
Exactly.
Of waste heat.
Yeah. Waste heat. as you transmit it down the line, it loses more and more of that charge. So Bitcoin miners can be placed right at the source to absorb that energy and create better load balancing. So they don't actually take any more electricity away from the world. They just absorb the wasted stuff.
Now, you mentioned recycling, and there are those that say the specialized computing infrastructure that's needed, and there are mountains of, you know, trash, electronic trash.
Right, right.
Thoughts on that? How do we get better with that?
Yeah, so those are called ASICs, application-specific integrated circuits. Those are what are Bitcoin miners. Uh-huh. So they're application-specific in the fact that they only do Bitcoin mining. All they do is they keep running Bitcoin mining equations, essentially. Those machines, based on the laws of physics, those chips can only get so small. And those chips are measured in nanometers. So the nanometer length is basically inside the chip how far away is all the other circuitry from the other circuitry. Mm-hmm. And the smaller the nanometers means you can put more processing power on the chip. Mm-hmm. So basically more processors can fit on it.
Yeah.
Well, these are quickly reaching a physics limitation of nanometer size, where pretty soon they're not going to be able to be any more efficient, which means that miners won't need to buy new ones every couple of years. They'll need to buy new ones every couple of decades. And so the miners will be created to last a very, very long time. In fact, I mean, they're vastly approaching that already to where they're lasting more like 5 years.
Okay.
So Bitcoin miners are reaching a physics limitation of processing power capabilities to where eventually they'll just be made to last eventually 50 or 100 years.
Okay.
Because the Bitcoin mining companies will buy them and hope that they last as long as they can so they can squeeze out all the incremental revenue from them.
Interesting. Now, one of the things that I think about is at South by here, so many fascinating presentations. But if you step back, we're talking about artificial intelligence and cyber and quantum computing. The world is getting more complex. And if you don't have a STEM background or a deep understanding of participation, you can fall behind and faster than ever before. We're in this era of exponential change, right? Is there that danger for folks that are in low-income communities, impoverished areas across the globe, that as this rockets forward, they don't get on the train? Is that danger real, Dan? And if so, how do we mitigate that danger?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you asked it before, too, and I didn't answer it. So this is a good time for me to touch on this. You know, when we look at like smartphone penetration in the population in terms of like how many people have a smartphone, it's pretty dang high across all socioeconomic sort of levels. Now, when we look at the like smartphone penetration or computer penetration in other countries like Ghana, Africa, or somewhere else, it's far lower. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's Bitcoin's moral responsibility to increase the number of hardware devices available for people across the world.
Okay.
It's just not something that Bitcoin has to do. What's cool, though, is once they do have a device, any device at all, including you can even like text and send Bitcoin that way, any device at all, you can access the Bitcoin network. And so that's a pretty low bar. And so I feel very comfortable that even lower income folks can access it. Mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. You can store your Bitcoin on a 12 word phrase.
Yeah.
So you can actually store Bitcoin in your head if you wanted to. You wouldn't even need an electronic device. I don't want to get too deep into how that works, but essentially the Bitcoin private key can be encoded into 12 words. Mm-hmm. And you can memorize that, and that's your Bitcoin wallet. So Bitcoin could actually exist in a non-digital world if you need it to be for a period of time before you want to use it again. So that's pretty accessible to almost anyone.
Interesting. Now, when we hit 23 million, and we're not far from that now, right?
21 million, and we're at 19,
21 million.
Yeah, that's right.
What happens when we hit that? Obviously, that creates scarcity. But even right now in gold, we haven't mined all the gold.
Right.
So what happens when we hit that 21 million?
That's a great question. So all of the electronics across the world turn off simultaneously. I'm just kidding. So what happens at 21 million is Bitcoin miners mine Bitcoin, or they take that energy and those costs, cost to acquire the energy and the cost of the equipment, and those miners are compensated with something called the block reward. The block reward is the compensation that they get for mining the Bitcoin block. The block reward is comprised of newly minted Bitcoin and transaction fees. Mm-hmm. So after the newly minted Bitcoin run out, 21 million, then that will be replaced by transaction fees to compensate the miners for the protection of the Bitcoin network.
Okay.
So that would be the first question that I would want to answer there, just to make sure that people realize that Bitcoin will be safe and secure even after 21 million are created. Now, that will take a very long time. The last Bitcoin will be mined in the year 2130.
Okay.
So that's quite a long time from now. I don't think any of us will be around
to
see it.
I'm in no hurry to get there, yeah.
Yeah. So I think it'll be okay. Now, it's an asymptotic supply curve. So 19 million have already been produced.
Why? And I'm not sure I'm understanding that. We've already done 19 million in a short time. Why will it take so long to do the last 2 million? Or will that be over 100 years?
This is one of my favorite questions to answer, because why did Satoshi choose that curve? No one knows.
Yeah.
But it worked. However he configured it, which is how he configured it, it worked.
Yeah.
Bitcoin's around. We're talking about it today. And so you could argue that you could have had a little bit more of a gradual slope to it, right? Mm-hmm. To where maybe you shouldn't produce so many so fast.
Right.
I believe that Satoshi, and this is 100% extrapolated and based on no data points.
Yeah.
But just based on my experience in reading Satoshi's writings and in my own opinion. I think he wanted to see Bitcoin succeed in his or her lifetime. Mm-hmm. So when you have halvings, so the halvings are when Bitcoin's supply production halves. And okay. so you have a halving until it reaches 21 million. Those halvings occurred in a way to where more Bitcoin are produced very early on. And I think that Satoshi wanted to sort of spur the ownership of Bitcoin and for people to go, wait a second, the supply is running out. I should get some while it's cheap.
Yeah.
And so it does create an interplay on that scarcity sort of element. And so I think it was more of a greedy aspect of Satoshi of just wanting to see it play out, just wanting to see if it would work or not. And it's a magnificent, incredible thing that was created.
Yeah.
But Bitcoin didn't have a price for a year. It wasn't worth a penny.
Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't always perceived as this thing is going to succeed. Satoshi didn't know.
Okay. So why Bitcoin over other cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say when we look at a cryptocurrency, it's not just about the parameters it has of code. The code and the community are somewhat intertwined. So for example, with Bitcoin, there are moments when people could... So when you run the code, each person can run the code and some people can make changes to the code and then say that I believe that this should be Bitcoin. And if everyone chooses to go with them, that could become Bitcoin.
Okay.
So like Bitcoin's code isn't 100% static. It changes over time with small tweaks, usually upgrades, and everyone agrees upon the upgrade. Same with other protocols as well, like Ethereum or Solana. Those are other more popular ones too. And so when we look at the ability to change Bitcoin's core code or core parameters, the Bitcoin community has actively resisted attempts to do that, which means that Bitcoin's community, I think, is the only credible one to preserve that 21 million hard cap. A 21 million monetary policy. Whereas other cryptocurrencies, and I'm not going to name which ones, over dozens and dozens of times have edited those rules or given themselves money or reversed the transactions. And when you do that, you destroy the core principle it has as like a money, a trustless money. And so I believe that Bitcoin is the only one that has a credible monetary policy long-term based on how its community has acted. Also, when we look at Bitcoin as well, it's got the strongest proof of work. Proof of work is the Bitcoin mining algorithm.
Yeah.
It's massive and it's magnitudes larger than all these other ones combined. So it has the highest amount of like protection, you could call it. And so that's why I think Bitcoin is one of the more secure chains, is because of that. So it's got that, the community, and also it decides to take kind of boring trade-offs. So other protocols, and I think that these are fun to go explore and they're really cool. They usually trade off decentralization. And so we probably should have covered that a little bit, but decentralization is essentially making sure that the protocol can't be changed by one person. And most of these other protocols decide to trade off decentralization for the ability to move faster and deploy code faster and make more changes. But that opens up attacks to change the money, to change what it is. And so Bitcoin moves slowly. It moves slowly and it doesn't make a lot of big changes to the protocol.
Yeah.
And it also hasn't introduced a lot of code types that would open up vulnerabilities. So as we know, with any system, with any sort of software, there's always a potential that there could be a flaw or exploit. So if Bitcoin changes less, that means there's less and less of a chance that a flaw is introduced. And so Bitcoin, by being boring, so some people think that's a flaw, actually makes it more stable and a better sound money over time. So that's why I like Bitcoin versus other things. I do think there's Bitcoin, and then there's all the other crypto assets that are acting more as like smart contract platforms or kind of more quasi-equity in a way. They're kind of trying to be like a new Facebook. And so they're not necessarily competing with Bitcoin's moneyness. They're more of trying to be a more inclusive gaming or financial system type play. I don't necessarily think that competes with Bitcoin trying to be the best money in the world. And there is some interplay between those two. So Bitcoin can somewhat communicate with these other blockchains and vice versa in different ways. So I don't think they're necessarily competitive. But for me, the core purpose of why I care about Bitcoin is because we need to replace the money. Mm. And so that's why I feel so passionate about that in particular.
Yeah, awesome. So a couple questions in wind down, and this has been a fascinating discussion. Let's say somebody that they're out there and they do want to invest, but carefully, only a portion in Bitcoin. What's your advice to them? Do you let it ride? Do you get in, get out? What would you advise folks that are considering this? What should their mindset be?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think this is one of the hardest parts about getting into Bitcoin is choosing how to get in.
Okay.
How to get in and how to stay in. Mm-hmm. So my last name is Held, by the way, which is it's a German last name, but is a very fortuitous one because HODL is the meme in this space. So for those who don't know what memes are kind of like a joke.
Yeah.
And HODL was written by an early Bitcoin participant about how the markets are so volatile that he tried to say the word HODL, but he misspelled it. And so HODL, or he tried to write hold, that he's going to keep holding on even though it's super volatile, and instead he misspelled it and it's called HODL. So that's the core rallying cry of the space is HODLing. Uh-huh. And why is that important? Why am I bringing this up? Because when you invest in Bitcoin, the first thing it's going to do is be choppy.
Yeah.
And you're going to wonder for a second, why did I get into this? Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, choose whatever level of risk you're willing to take. Because Bitcoin could go to zero. Mm-hmm. Same with any other asset.
Right.
So choose what amount of money you're willing to risk to lose. And then understand why you're getting into the investment. Mm-hmm. So my investment thesis back in 2012, Bitcoin is going to be digital gold. And so we are very much along that path, but we have not touched on that yet. Mm-hmm. So I still haven't sold mine.
Okay.
So for me, I think there's still a lot of appreciation to go. Of course, it's subjective. We don't know what's going to happen. And so people should learn, okay, I'm going to enter this investment. And this, by the way, pertains to Bitcoin and every other asset. Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy this investment. I'm going to hold it for a while and see what happens. So don't have this, you know, day trader mindset where you go in and out, because you're not going to beat the big guys and who understand how these markets work, and they've got billions of dollars that they trade daily. Mm-hmm. With every investment I buy in HODL, I like to watch and see over 5 to 10 years how it plays out.
Yeah.
So that's what I would recommend. Just choose some sum of money. Just choose to HODL it. And if you're going to go buy it at Kraken.
Yeah.
Kraken is the exchange I work at. And Kraken is a great place. We also have some of the cheapest fees out there.
Uh-huh.
So definitely recommend people check out Kraken.com if they want to go buy some.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned before this word of adoption, and the more adoption, the more the surfing gets smoother on this
wave. Right.
What are some of the things that we need to do to drive adoption? What's going to be required, right, to get us to that point of where people say, oh, no, this isn't something that is crazy or overly volatile. It makes sense. How do we drive adoption?
Well, I think there's a singular metric that we can look at that represents adoption, the price.
Okay.
The price of Bitcoin represents the aggregate shared belief that it's worth something. Mm-hmm. The higher it goes, the more aggregate shared belief there is. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen this over time since Bitcoin was $10. That's when I first got into it. Mm-hmm. And no one believed it was worth anything back then.
Yeah.
That's why it was worth $10, is the aggregate shared belief in its value was very low. Mm-hmm. Nothing about Bitcoin changed from now and since then till now. Mm-hmm. Literally nothing.
Yeah.
But people's belief in it changed. And so Bitcoin's adoption is purely based on belief, price, and these are somewhat intertwined in a reflexive sort of pattern. Mm-hmm. Soros came up with the idea of reflexivity. As something goes higher in price, there's a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. So when something goes higher in price and it's now socially validated in your mind that it is valuable.
Yeah.
And so there's this reflexive loop that occurs where Bitcoin keeps going up in price. It doesn't go to zero, and people's trust in it builds and builds mm-hmm. over time. Also, as the price goes higher, your neighbor tells you about it. And your neighbor tells you about how much money he made, and then you're like, maybe I should get into this.
Yes.
And so that core reflexive loop taps into the raw human emotion of greed.
The psychology behind this is mind-blowing.
Oh, it's wild. It's crazy.
Yeah. My last question for you. You have been now for several years, really since this started, Satoshi and so forth, doing incredibly well in this space, guiding people, advising people, investing. What's next for you? I mean, this is incredibly exciting times. What's next for you over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So, you know, I've had a career in the space almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I've sold two companies, one to Kraken, and I've worked from everything from wallet software to to exchanges, that's what Kraken is, to price tracking apps. So I've kind of done it all. Mm-hmm. Over the last 4 years, I started to write about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're talking today. So this is, I would say, somewhat separate from my corporate career, mm-hmm. which is writing about Bitcoin and helping more and more people discover it.
Sure.
So a little bit more on that side, I think, would be really fun for me. I work in lead growth marketing at Kraken, which is also equally thrilling. Mm-hmm. But you know, being able to talk about Bitcoin and get millions of people into Bitcoin is a really big passion of mine. So kind of leaning more into that while also working at Kraken. Kraken has tremendous resources, and we've got millions of users across the world. So the ability to kind of marry those two together is kind of the perfect dream job for me.
I love it. The storytelling aspect.
Exactly.
Thoughtfully communicating to people why this makes sense, why there's value. Started off, I was excited to have this discussion. And I will tell you, you have given me things that I'm going to go back and think about and ponder. Because every misconception I had, you've said, well, what about this? How about that? And they've all been very thoughtful. So Dan, I'm thrilled that you came in and talked to us. And perhaps in the future, I'd love to go even deeper on the psychology of value,
absolutely.
Money, of greed. Because I feel like we could talk for an hour or two or three on just that.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah, this was a ton of fun. And I think that we call it the proverbial Bitcoin rabbit hole. That there's all these different pathways of like psychology, money, and these different ways to go. So it would absolutely be a blast to do this again.
Okay. Dan, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet.
So are you ready to get invested in Bitcoin? Cliff's already in. He's out there, he's getting the apps, he's moving on it. Maybe you're not convinced yet. Maybe I'm not convinced yet, but a couple key takeaways that I thought were so interesting. One is this perception of value. I thought that was fascinating, and the psychology behind what value is. And frankly, how difficult when you bring a new idea in, it can be for all of us to wrap our minds around that. I also thought it was interesting regarding energy. One of the criticisms of Bitcoin and all of the blockchain and the mining is, oh, it releases so much CO2. But what he was talking about when we talked about energy from other places and actually being able to recycle, those were really cool parts of it that I liked. I also like that this show is about thinking different, being different. And Dan was able to do that. He's got me thinking differently. I don't know if I'm convinced yet, but I'll spend months thinking on this. So really great to talk with Dan. So conversations like this are why we're excited to be at South by Southwest. They're why we're excited to do this show. We are fully bought in on doing it because we just love this idea of this intersection of ideas, this different thought. So keep being different.
GovCon Different. Ideas from the outside applied to GovCon to drive change.
It's like TED Talks meets the federal space.
Different ideas from different industries, uncovered, unvarnished, and smashed together to produce change in the government space. Join us as we explore a world of GovCon possibilities.